Hi, this is Circe Olson Westner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Together We Serve. I'm pleased to have author Rick Tavares back on our show. There's lots to talk about today, so let's just jump right in. Hey, Rick, hi.
Aloha, Circe. It's been a while.
Yeah, well, it doesn't seem so long ago. You were just on this show and you were talking about having written your first book, you know, your first book ever. It began in Japan. And so now you've written a second book and it's been in a really short time. Is that less than a year even?
Yeah, it has. I'm actually surprised by that. Because as you know, I wasn't originally planning to do a sequel, but peer pressure overcame. So I decided to go ahead and do it because I was actually working on, I believe I mentioned to you, I was actually working on a romance novel that takes place in Paris during COVID.
Oh.
But the peer pressure overwhelmed me, so I decided to go ahead and do the sequel. And I already had a storyline. Mm-hmm. I just didn't realize, I just didn't want to, I wanted to do the romance novel, but I didn't know I completed this book in under a year. So I was really surprised by that.
Wow. Well, it's called After Japan, The Pursuit, and it picks up where the first book ended. And, you know, I always admire people who can write multiple volumes of fiction. I'm amazed that they can keep all the complicated pieces and parts, you know, these people who can write these multi-part novels, like, you know, The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings or TV series, how they can keep track of all the characters and coming up with plots. So that's the first thing I wanted to talk to you about today is how do you keep track of your characters and your different plot twists and put them down logically?
That's a great question, Circe. Let's see. Well, for me, I believe the key was to limit the number of protagonists. And, you know, the other key, and I've mentioned this to you before, there was this author, Kevin Kwan, who wrote the Crazy Rich Asians trilogy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
One of the things he said was, write what you know. So, as you know, I personally have decades long relationship with the three protagonists. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that difficult to incorporate character to development in the story. So I wanted to keep it simple and limit the number of protagonists, the number of characters. Mm-hmm. And you know, that helped. In fact, funny story, if you indulge me for a second, that one of the protagonists, when we were going over the storyline, one of the things he was concerned about is, so am I going to die in this story?
Well,
I told him, well, as long as you don't upset me, you won't. But I'm not going to tell you if he did or he didn't. You'll just have to read the book of the sequel to find out. But, you know, I mean, someone has to die, whether it's him or not. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's totally just going, you know, there's also jail and police and arrest. So hopefully you're not basing it too much on real life. Hey,
no.
So were you a creative kid as a little kid? Were you one of those kids that wrote stories or doodled pictures during class or got called out for too much imagination? Or were your teachers kind of encouraging you?
I'm laughing.
Yeah.
Because, no, the teachers probably told me to be quiet. I talk too much. But, you know, I've mentioned to you before that, you know, in school, I was kind of an academically underachieving student. And school just didn't really interest me. I was more interested in playing sports. And as long as my grade point average didn't affect, you know, I didn't allow my grade point average to affect my playing sports.
Right.
So, you know, I really wasn't challenged that way. And it's, you know, I mean, it's not so much the teachers or the school or anything like that. It was just me. I just kind of had an apathetic approach to education at that particular time in my life. But I always thought I've had an overactive imagination. I mean, even when I was playing sports, like if I was outside playing basketball, I'd be thinking about, you know, one of the superstars, you know, I'd be thinking I was like Elgin Baylor or Jerry West playing basketball, and it's 3 seconds left on the clock and we're trailing by 1 point. And if I make this basket, you know, we'll win the game. So I would play things and do things like that. Even as a kid growing up, I would, you know, being a military brat, you know, I had my dad's bayonet, I had his helmet, canteen, and I would go out in the fields and play war games and imagine, you know, I was some super soldier saving the world. And, you know, so my imagination has always been there. In fact, one of the reasons I was asked to write the book is to temper my overactive imagination. They said, you need to put it to use. Why don't you write?
So you did get some encouragement there. Yeah. You know, I remember one of my teachers wrote on my report card, Circe has too much confidence. There was nothing about talent. I don't know how a kid can have too much confidence, but maybe that's like imagination.
Well, you know, another thing too, is I had the protagonist when I told him that, you know, here's the story I was thinking about writing. They constantly encouraged me. And I mentioned the last podcast about Bunny Brown. Oh, dear Bunny Brown. She's the one that actually introduced me to your organization. Uh-huh. And just said, dude, you need to be a part of this organization and start telling our stories using their anthologies. In fact, if you remember the very first one, Brat Times.
Brat Time Stories. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, my article just so happens to be is the 19th article on page 64.
Okay.
So, and I'm going to use the word that you love me using, serendipitous. See, I'm older now. I could use that word serendipitous now.
I've got that word down. I love that word.
the 19th article on page 64, It's serendipitous because when I wrote the first book, it began in Japan. I actually arrived in Japan in 1964.
You know, I think they call that foreshadowing or something.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, and you know, if you remember, the article was called Reflections of a Military Brat. And what I wrote about was my first love. And I wrote that that article is it because everybody has a first love, and I thought it would be something that people could relate to, especially military brats.
Right.
And the feedback I got from that article was really overwhelming in the sense that people could relate to that. They've had similar experiences and stuff like that. So that was kind of a motivator for me to keep going because of the feedback I got from that very first article. I wasn't expecting it. Oh. And I just wanted to tell the story. And so that kind of kept me motivated and going, you know, writing those articles for your y'all's anthologies. And then Bunny always saying, dude, you need to write a book. You need to tell our story, you know.
Well, so let's just continue that then. So both of your stories, both of your books take place in locations like Japan and Hawaii and Seattle. And are those places that you grew up in as a brat, since you're telling brat stories, or did you just pick them randomly? I know you said you lived in Japan.
Yeah. Well, all of those places that I talk about in the story, I've actually lived in, with the exception of Seattle. Now, I visited Seattle on several occasions. In fact, Taylor in the book still lives in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And so I would go up there and visit with him, and then he would take me around. So all those places I described, like Dick's Hamburgers, I was there, had a Dick's Hamburger and a strawberry shake. So mm-hmm. I wrote about that. Some of the places that I visited in Seattle, I wrote about that. Pike's Peak, Pike's Fish Market.
Right, right. And,
yeah, I've been there. I even caught the fish and
did all Well, I was just going to ask you, you can tell that you have definitely done research on your locations, because you did. You write down what people ate and, you know, things like that. But I wanted to ask you, did writing these books give you an excuse to travel to Hawaii and Japan, or did you just, you know, remember what you'd done a couple of years ago? Or did you say, well, you know, now it's research, I can go and I can write it off on my text. I don't know what people do, but you know, did you research or did you just go from memory?
Okay, so are the tax people listening?
No, no. Okay, let's not even talk about taxes. Yeah. I have no idea.
Yes, yes, yes. I did all those things. Part of it was to reconnect with mm-hmm. old friends. Part of it was research. And I knew about those places. So, you know, like Kevin said, you know, write what you know. So I knew those places. So I went back then. I went back looking like for the romance novel. I went back to Paris three times to research, mm-hmm. I even looked up, I even Googled, you know, romantic places in Paris. And I went and visited those places to see how I could incorporate it into story. So I think it's important, you know, I take pictures of those places so I can look back, and when I'm describing something, I can do that. I no longer had, but I had copies of menus that I would mm-hmm. take. So when I would describe food.
Well, we can tell you like to eat, because that was a big part of the books. Like, yeah, they're having a double something fudge, this, that, or the other. So the detail aside, another overarching idea, it's not exactly a theme, I'm not sure how to call it, but maybe an expression, is that brat friendships are forever. Is that how, and it sounds like, because you keep saying you have kept in touch with the people that became your protagonist, is that how your brat friendships have been forever?
God, wow. Excuse me. That's really kind of hard to describe, because as you know, for example, Japan, you know, the three protagonists, you know, we're all very close. And then, you know, we go off to college and, you know, for maybe a year or so we communicate, and then it just wanes. And, you know, so like I hadn't seen the three protagonists in over 40 years when we met. But, you know, we would hear through the grapevine from other folks how, so how's so-and-so doing? Oh, yeah, okay. So, you know, with brats, it's really hard to, you know, because we didn't have social media. Nowadays, it's probably easy to maintain those relationships because you've got Facebook, you know, all these various mediums that you could use to stay in contact. But back then, you know, it's letter writing, you know, and I'm not much of a letter writer, and mm-hmm. I'm a talker. So it was kind of difficult to do that. You know, once we got together, you know, 40 years later, 40 plus years later, when we got together, it was just like we saw each other yesterday.
Right, right. That's what people keep saying. It's like, boom, instantly back in 10th grade or, you know, whatever.
And in my books, you know, some people said, do you guys actually banter that much? Oh, yeah, that's our relationship. We banter a lot.
Well, you know, I know you've been to some of your high school reunions and also to some of the overseas brats events. And why do you think, and you kind of alluded to it just now, but why do you think brats seek each other out, even across generations and experiences, and then they connect instantly? We're back like 40 years ago. What is it? Why do you think that happens?
Wow. I think it's just a kind of unexplainable association or relationship of why those kinds of things happen. I just know they do. My experience, you know, I've run into people that I didn't even know. We went to high school different times. I didn't even know. But when we would meet, mm-hmm. it was just like we were old buddies again. Mm-hmm. And, it's, you know, we just had a shared experience, I guess. And that's what connects us, is that shared experience. I can't explain why it's, I just know it does.
Well, you're both a brat and a veteran. So do you feel that same esprit de corps with your fellow vets that you do with?
Absolutely. I think the same dynamics occur as it does with brats, as with my military buddies and stuff that I spent time with. You know, we still have that. We may not, again, we may not see each other for years or talk to each other for years, but when we get together, you know, it's just like, you know, we met each other yesterday, and you know, it just like nothing changed. It just moved on, just moved forward. So, yeah.
So I was wondering if your parents, and especially your mom, if she or if they maintain close bonds with other military couples or spouses after they got out. Do you know? Do you remember?
Yes. My mother in particular, she was diagnosed with a brain tumor. So she had, you know, back in the day in the 60s, your cobalt treatment. And anyway, she didn't, her neck was scarred. She lost her sense of taste and smell. So she didn't socialize a lot. She wore turtlenecks all the time to hide all the burns around her neck from the treatment and from the cancer treatment back then. So she didn't socialize a lot in Japan, but our friends would come over, you know, to the house, and she had both my parents had a really close relationship with our friends. In fact, I was jealous of Taylor for years, because I always thought that my parents thought Taylor was the son they wished for.
Yeah, well, that happens a lot. I know a lot of my friends say,
yeah, he was so charismatic and kind and everything. And my parents just loved him, you know. Like, I could just say, hey, mom and dad, I'm going to Taylor's. And they would say, okay. You know, his parents, you know, he would tell his parents, hey, I'm going to Pineapples. Oh, okay. So it was like, you know, no checks or balances or, you know, a lecture about doing this or that or anything like that. It was just like, okay, you're going to Taylor's. All right, fine. You know. So, yeah, but they did, even after Japan, you know, there were friends that visited, you know, my parents, and or if they came by, because my sister and brother lived in the same town that my parents retired in. So when some of their friends would come over, they'd go and see my parents as well. So, yeah, they maintained that relationship even after Japan.
Wow. You know, our museum is always trying to find connections and, you know, capture history and experiences across the spectrum of military family members. And, you know, that's why we encourage people to send in their stories, you know, or to be interviewed, you know, because what you said is right about the brats, you know, shared connections, even across generations. There's always some common ground. Mm-hmm. You know, I interviewed a World War II wife, and she and I snickered about some of the same issues that I experienced in the 80s. It was just kind of, it was, even our lives were quite different, they were quite similar. So I was, you know, but a lot of times people are stereotypically thinking that brats all have the same experiences, or spouses. And they don't.
Correct.
Right. So I wanted to just, you know, kind of think about that when we elicit, you know, we ask people for stories, we want to encourage very many perspectives of stories. And that's why we include in our exhibits direct quotes from people and try to show all the military, the different aspects of military life, you know, and sometimes the quotes contradict themselves. You know, it's like one quote, this was the greatest thing, this was the worst thing. But, you know, it's all important. And so the relationships that we forge as military family members is just incredibly wonderful and really hard to explain to other people. So getting back to your books, I wanted to tell people, and we've said this before, you know, all proceeds from all the sales go directly to the museum, and we really, really appreciate that. But I wanted to know, why did you feel compelled to give away profits for something you worked really, really hard on? You know, I don't think too many people would do that. So why did you think that you should work really hard, write novels, and then just donate all the money instead of keeping it, going on another trip to somewhere exciting?
Well, that's easy. That's a good softball question there.
Oh, okay.
Simply put, it's just that I believe in what the museum is doing. I'm always a proponent of brats or military family members. I believe that we should be telling our story and not leaving it to others, because I think we have the understanding, we have the sensitivity. And I think it's important that you guys provide the avenues, the mediums for people like myself to tell our stories, so people become more understanding and sensitive to our experiences, because there's not a lot of stories out there about what military families go through. And then some of them have been, you know, Hollywood has taken, you know, those certain Hollywood liberties and embellished and kind of, you know, not really told an accurate representation of what military life is all about. So I like what you guys are doing. I like the idea that we give military family members and military members and brats the opportunity to tell our story as we see it, because I agree with you. I mean, to go back to your earlier comment, as far as I'm concerned, there's no question that there's a richness. There's just a richness of being a military brat. Mm-hmm. And the richness is the beauty of our diversity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're not a monolithic group, and we're typically stereotyped as being a certain way, and not realizing that, you know, we come from all diverse backgrounds, and how we were socialized are so different, but yet the commonality of being a brat brings us together, and it's a shared experience where some of those differences don't divide us or aren't divisive, but they bring us together. And we have that commonality. Now, there's no question that, you know, in our present tumultuous times, and with the advent of and the proliferation of social media tools, it's clear that the differences, it's clear that we have differences, thoughts and beliefs, you know, among brats, just because of the social media out there.
Right. Well, you know, and
that's okay. That's what we all are about.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And that's one of the things I have found, that brats are not afraid to speak their mind, but also to listen to each other. So getting back to your books, where can people buy them?
On Amazon.
All right. Amazon. I'll put the links under the podcast, so that people can find the go click and check out your books. But in addition to selling on Amazon, you also do book signings and author talks. And do you have any plans to be at any sort of reunion or a bookstore in the near future where people can meet you, talk story?
I love that. Talk story. You go.
Okay.
Yes, I love the talk story. We have actually our high school, Johnson High School from in Japan. We actually have a reunion in Vegas, October the 9th through the 12th. It just so happens that all four of us, the four protagonists in my books, are all going to be there. So we've made ourselves available for those people that are interested, that we will autograph your books and we'll take pictures with you if you would like. So that's going to be really cool.
That'll be interesting to meet the real people.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was really cool. So the timing of it is perfect. And we have that reunion in Vegas, October the 9th through the 12th. And then my apartment complex actually is going to be holding a book signing for me, I'm just like a couple miles from Fort Sam Houston. And so there's a lot of military people, medical military people, stuff like that, going to school and stuff, that live here in the area. So the apartment manager thought it would be a great idea if I had a book signing. So I'm going to have a book signing October the 17th here. And she's getting ready to promote it. I already sent her a little press release, a little bio, proposed bio that I have with pictures. And she's working it right now to go ahead and share it, you know, with the group here. So I have that. And then I'll be attending. There's an overseas Bratz gathering October the 19th through the 22nd in San Antonio. So it's all Bratz throughout the world. It's not, you know, like, you know, our high school reunion. It's mm-hmm. Bratz. So I'll be attending that as well. And then I have a book signing here right across the street at the historic Pearl District, at the Twig Bookshop. So I have a book signing on December the 10th.
Wow. You are just like all over.
That's just the beginning. That's just the beginning.
Oh my gosh.
I'm also will be making myself with this podcast. One of the things I'll do is I'll make myself available. In fact, I'm visiting with somebody Saturday who purchased both of my books and read them and even wrote a review for me on Amazon. Huh? I'm actually meeting her for lunch Saturday so I can autograph both her books. And she's also been responsible for she's also shared this information with her friends, and I've already had, I think, three or four of her friends already purchased the books. So, wow. So I'm going to make myself available to people here in the area that I would join them for lunch or breakfast or dinner or whatever, and visit with them, talk about the book, and then obviously talk about the museum, and then autograph the books for them. Wow. I have some other ideas, but right now I want to get through this podcast. And
yeah. Wow. You are definitely going to be a social butterfly with this. Hey, yeah. So we've mentioned that you participated, you got involved in our anthologies. I know you have stories in, you know, three of them, because, you know, the Brat Time stories and then Host Nation Hospitality and Schooling with Uncle Sam. And you also got a lot of people, and, you know, you've already talked about that, to also submit their stories. And yeah. So why is recording personal history so important, do you think?
Well, I just believe that we should be the authors of our story. Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, I've visited with various brats through the years, and I know there are some very inspiring stories. There's some unbelievable sad stories, just some incredible stories that I think that need to be told. And so I would like them to, you know, to tell their own story. And, you know, the museum provides them that opportunity, as opposed to somebody telling that doesn't really know us telling our story. So right. I'm just an advocate of, you know, us telling our own story.
Right. Wow. Well, listen, I hope you're not too totally exhausted from this novel writing and all of these different events you're going to go to, because the next year, the museum is going to be compiling stories for two more anthologies. Breaking news, everybody. Breaking news. One is specific. Okay, just hold on. One is specifically focusing on Bratz's story. So stay tuned, everybody. There's going to be a specific title for that one. And another one is going to be about federal employees. So, you know, anybody who worked for any of the federal agencies, and, you know, so those announcements are going to go out pretty soon. So I want you to warm up your laptop, Rick. Be prepared.
It's ready.
In the olden days, we would have said sharpen your pencil, but we're beyond that.
Yeah, no, that's great.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that. I have some people lined up that I've already talked to at the reunion. I will be visiting one in particular, and I'll get her to tell her story, because it's a very inspiring story. She's
don't give it away. Don't give it away. Psst. Spoiler alert. Yep. Because
I'll be working on her and a couple of other people to tell those stories.
Yeah, no, it sounds great. I just had a gentleman email us today, and he said, I have a really good story that took place in Vietnam. Would you be interested? And I'm like, yes, please. It's very interesting. So people are beginning to really reach out and just say, listen, I have a story that needs to be recorded for, you know, for the ages. So another thing that you and I are going to be working on is to create a special footlocker that focuses on items from the different places in your book. So we'll be featuring items, you know, that Japan brats have donated and California brats and Hawaii brats and, you know, other places that are in your book. I mean, you know, in Washington state, there are bases. So we're going to start, you know, looking to get artifacts and you know, stories from people who have lived in those places. And then, you know, if possible, while you're going to all these other events, it's too bad we don't have more time, you could take a footlocker full of these things, you know, and, you know, it's like every time I talk to you, you've just come back from some exotic place. So who knows where this footlocker is going to go in your travels. So I think that'll be a lot of fun. And then that also gives you talking points, you know, like the shirt you're wearing. Unfortunately, this is not a video interview, but you're wearing an Aloha shirt with quite an interesting story behind it. That would be a good talking point for the Foot Locker. Mm-hmm. It's very dapper. It's got parrots on it and it's from a famous TV show. I don't know. Do we want to tell people or do we want to just...
Actually, the shirt that I'm wearing is in the Smithsonian Institute, and Tom Selleck wore it when he was doing Magnum PI.
Mm-mm.
And it was a really funny story. I was walking Main Street in Fredericksburg. I was up there visiting. That's wine country. So I was up there and I saw this shirt in a store window. Mm-hmm. And then I saw a paper clipping of Tom Selleck wearing the shirt. Mm-hmm. And I read the article and I go, oh, my God, it's in the Smithsonian. So I went into the store and I said, do you have this shirt? And he goes, oh, yeah. He said, what size do you wear? And I said, OK. And so I purchased the shirt. So it's kind of it was just coincidence.
Serendipitous.
I didn't want to use the word.
Oh, hey.
I didn't want to use the word.
So moving on to an announcement I put out earlier on our social media, you know, you joined the board of directors for the museum. Woohoo! And we're so excited to have you as director of marketing. So I wanted to say, you know, and talking to you, and I even know that our listeners are able to figure this out. Marketing seems to come natural to you based on things you've been doing. I mean, you're always out there. You're championing the museum. You're championing other brats groups and causes. You're making connections and encouraging people to participate. And, you know, different organizations are always trying to do something with brats, or, you know, we're trying to do programs and anthologies. And it seems to me that you really enjoy building relationship and being an encouragement to people. Mm-hmm. And so when we were, you know, thinking about board members, I wasn't sure you had the time with all the stuff you're doing, especially, you know, the writing the two books in a year. But I decided to ask you to join the board and you accepted. And so I've never asked this question. I've never even thought about this question until like a few seconds ago. What did you think when I asked you? Were you flattered or were you like, oh gosh, now I have to figure out how to tell her no or whatever? I get asked to do stuff and it's like, oh, I don't know.
Well, first of all, I was surprised because and humbled at the offer, because in retrospect, think back that, you know, it was Bunny Brown that said, Rick, you need to be a part of this organization and contribute articles to tell the story about brats. Mm-mm. And how all that started, and it's now evolved to this.
Mm-mm.
I'm not a writer, you know that. I'm not a writer academically or professionally. You know, that wasn't my academic background or anything like that. I'm just a storyteller, and I fell into this, and then, you know, writing the articles, getting the feedback, and then all of a sudden this.
Mm-hmm.
It's overwhelming, you know. So I was surprised as well as humbled by the offer, and I immediately accepted it because I think that what it does for me, it provides me, I don't know, the legitimate leverage to do what I've been doing anyway.
Oh, but you know? See, You don't need legitimacy. You are like authentic and awesome. So,
but, you know, when I could say I am the director of marketing, you know, for the American Military Family and Learning Center.
I think we need to find something for Bunny to do. She seems to be the biggest cheerleader.
But, yes. Yeah.
But I wanted our listeners to know how much we appreciate your coming on board, especially because right now most people have seen my announcement that the museum is in transition. And so I wanted to tell people who, you know, came into the conversation a little late, we're moving out of our present location because our wonderful, our magnificent, our fantastic supportive landlady, the owner of Molly's Bar, died suddenly, and the bar is now permanently closed. So, you know, she was an awesome person for the museum. Actually, I have a story now, if you'll indulge me on going down memory lane. So there's a little bit of a story about how we ended up in Tijeras in the first place. It's very serendipitous. So we were renting the top floor in a charter school in Albuquerque in 2015, I think it was. And suddenly the school lost its charter. And we were told that we had 2 months to vacate the building or we were going to risk losing everything because I guess they were going to come in and chain off the, I don't know what happens when things happen. But anyway, we had to get out now. And so we started packing up all our stuff, but we didn't know what to do or where we were going or anything. It was kind of alarming. And at the time I lived out in the East Mountains, that's outside of Albuquerque. And I was driving by Molly's Bar in Tijeras one evening, and I saw a big sign on the roof that said, for rent. And, you know, I hadn't really considered a whole lot of buildings on Route 66 because there'd been one or two that I'd looked at, and they were just either too small or too expensive or both. So I didn't have a whole lot of hope, but, you know, I had to try because I had to. Plus, I felt this kind of a pull. So I pull into the parking lot right in front of the bar, look at the sign right on the roof in front of me, and I dialed the number. And this woman answered, and I said, and I explained who I was. I told a little bit about our museum, and she said, hold on a minute. And then she put her husband on the phone, and that was Romeo DeLallo. And it turns out that Romeo was a veteran and he loved the idea of our museum going into, you know, Molly's Bar, next door to Molly's Bar. And what was really cool about it is that the space that they were renting out was actually Romeo's mother's house. So Molly, who owned the bar originally, started the bar like 75 years ago. Any rate, she lived in the house that was attached to the bar. And so the space was his mother's house. And he thought that would be perfect for us to put our museum in. And of course I love the idea because, you know, what better than a military family museum in a house. But I told him we didn't have a whole lot of money and we would be good tenants. You know, we'd behave ourselves. And he didn't even hesitate. He said, we want you. And that's how kind of the relationship started. And it was just a random thing. I just was driving home and boom, for rent. Have you ever had anything random but positive happen to you?
Oh, a lot of things in my career, things. I mean, but, you know, to bring it closer to home, how our relationship began. Do you know? I didn't know who you were. I was just writing the article. And I think it was Laura who was responsible for the first.
Yeah.
I communicated with her, you know, about the anthology. So just the beginning of our relationship,
mm-hmm.
you know, was unexpected and, you know, it was an unexpected happening.
Yeah. I have a lot of things like that too, that happen. And I have to say that every day I am grateful for serendipitous moments and the connections I have made just through the museum. And I'm also grateful for people like Romeo and Diane, because seriously, they didn't know us, and they could have gotten a lot more money. I told them we didn't have much, and they gave us a rent that was really good. And what happened next was that Romeo died only a few months after we moved in. So I actually never physically saw him. I only talked to him on the phone. But Diane, his wife, lovely, was always supportive, accessible, came by the museum. You know, she was just there. But it was kind of cool. The building that was, you know, Molly's bar is in and our museum is in, is old, and it had a, you know, had some drawbacks, but it was Molly's house, like I said, and our space, literally, you'd go down the hall and open the door and you're in the bar. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, people would come by the museum and just peek in and see what, you know, and then they would say things like, they'd come right into the living room, because, you know, house, and say, we got married right in front of this fireplace. Or look, that's where she used to have her kitchen table. And wow. And Molly was a justice of the peace. And so over the years, over the decades, she had married many, many, many people in our kitchen.
And oh, wow.
Room. You know, her kitchen and living room, you know, but every once in a while, somebody would come from the bar and they'd say things like, did you know that Molly used to come charging right down that hall with a shotgun in her hand and she would break up fights in the bar? So it was kind of an interesting place to rent, you know, a local legend had lived there. So anyway, we stayed for 7 years. And now it's, unfortunately, it's the end of an era. And, you know, but if there's one thing we military families know, it's ends of eras and moving and change. So we're doing it. Hey, thinking now. How many times did you move as a military brat and also in the service? I'm just thinking now of moves. My brain just went boop, moving.
So I was born and spent 5 years in Hawaii. So let's see. Six times in 18 years. So I'm only counting to when I went off to college. So I moved six times in 18 years. In the military, 11 times in 22 years.
Wow. So that's a lot of moves. Yeah.
17 times in 40 years. I didn't major in math.
But 17 yeah, me neither, but that was a lot of moves.
Altogether, you know, 17 times in 40 years. Yeah.
Wow. It's funny, sometimes I'm wandering through the museum or even in my own personal home, and I still find moving stickers on the back of a bookshelf or under a rug. Just the other day. And I was gonna take a picture of it for the, you know, for the Facebook and just say, hey, look what I found, you know. Has that ever happened to you? You walk through your house and all of a sudden you find
boxes, you know, still got boxes and, carrying boxes from one move to another, you know, oh yeah, I took this to here. Yeah. And then, but even though I've also have found stuff that I thought I lost.
Yeah.
You know, like my favorite pin, you know.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, you know, now the moving stickers have like are self-adhesive and they have barcodes on them. So yeah. I would think that makes it harder to lose stuff. I mean, we've moved twice now. It's some major moves in the last couple of years and we didn't lose anything and nothing broke. One PCS, like when we moved to New Mexico, our movers lost half our bed. I am not sure how you can lose half a bed, but they did, and they didn't ever find it.
Somebody must have needed half a bed.
Somebody must have needed half a bed. So do you have any funny moving stories that you can share real quick?
My moving experiences typically have not been pleasant.
Tragic moving stories.
You know, dented, scratched, missing. Yeah, I'm trying to think right now. I can't, off the top of my head, I can't think of anything that was a pleasant move other than I survived it.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, I guess actually, we should get back to what we were focusing on in this podcast, and we were supposed to be focusing on you. So what are some of the things you'd like to do as marketing director?
Well, I'm going to continue doing what I have been doing, and what I like to do is building professional and personal relationships, connecting with other, you know, businesses and organizations to promote, you know, our benevolent mission and the museum, and you know, establishing the new connections, networking, and you know, so I'll be doing a lot of that, glad handing and stuff like that. So, you know, and then, you know, continuing my social media presence. I know I only use Facebook for the most part. I'm probably going to have to go to Instagram and other stuff too. And I'd be grudging. You know, to be honest, I was actually going to leave Facebook after this book was published, you know?
You can't now. Sorry.
I know.
But think of some of the fun things. We're also, you know, you're going to do this pop-up in San Antonio area, or, you know, someplace in Texas. So we'll keep everybody posted. And the museums is going to be doing a series of pop-up displays in Stuttgart, Germany, and then, of course, in Albuquerque. And then I'm going to be joining a German historian leading a walking tour of the Perlacher Forest housing area in Munich in October. And we've just hired a museum manager part-time who's going to be joining the team in early December. So there's a lot of good stuff going on. And so getting back to, you know, your books and, you know, how we feel about relationships and things. Now that you've written a couple of books, are you comfortable in the success? I know that sounds like a really stupid question, but sometimes people who are highly successful still feel it's not real. It's hard to accept that you've written a book and people like it. What is that? Imposter syndrome, maybe? So how are you dealing with publicity? It sounds like you're doing great. Comments about your book.
Well, you know, I try not to take myself too seriously, you know. I take the feedback, you know, at face value. And that doesn't mean that I'm not disappointed by some of the things being said or suggested, or that my head doesn't explode from the praise. But, you know, I try to keep that balance, you know, because I know I'm not a writer, and that wasn't me academically or professionally. I know I'm not a James Patterson or Colleen Hoover, Michael Conley, or John Grisham, or any of those other people. And, you know, I just wrote two books that I hope provided the reader the opportunity to identify with and enjoy the story. You know, I used to tell my students that, you know, the only way you're going to be a good speaker is you have to speak. The only way you're going to be a good writer is you have to write. So my students really didn't like the fact that they had to do a paper and present it and write it at the same time. But I said, you know, it's incumbent upon me to give you those opportunities. So, I really feel, because I think the more you speak, the more you write, the better you get at it, you know. And I think that the sequel, personally, I thought it was a better story. And although, as you know, I hate, and I will never, ever, and I told you that the last time, write in the third person again.
Well, no, it was the present tense, or yeah, it's in the now. Everything is happening right now. Well, I don't believe anything you said, because you said you were never going to write another book, and now you're on your second. So I have to ask this, a third book, a trilogy, a quartet, or is that one of those things that it's going to just have to be a wait and see?
Stop it. Okay. Yes, I have briefly thought of doing a trilogy. In fact, if I had the experience of a writer, what I, you know, I think I might have mentioned to you that I thought that if I had known what I was going to do a sequel, I probably would have wrote one book and make it into a big novel. In other words, combine both books.
Right.
You know, but yeah, I have thought about, and I have a storyline already, you know, for a trilogy. But I really don't want to do that. I really want to, you know, do my romance novel of a, you know, incorporating a brat story in that romance novel, because, you know, most romance novels are young people that are well-to-do. You know, I want to talk about, you know, old people do fall in love. So I kind of want to tell that story.
Well, I encourage you to write that. Well, okay, so people, you're hearing it. There may be another story, but you may have to wait until the romance novel taking place in Paris with brats, apparently, happens.
I thought that about the sequel, and I did the sequel first. I just tabled the romance. So that doesn't mean I, you know, it depends on the feedback that I get.
Okay. Speaking of feedback, what would you tell somebody who is like you, not a writer, didn't think was ever going to be a writer, who all of a sudden has said, okay, well, if Rick can write a book, I can write a book. Maybe I could write a book. What would you tell them? How would you, what advice would you give a writer? I know you said, you know, do you have to speak? You have to speak a lot to get better. You have to write a lot to get better. But what about somebody who is like, yeah, I can't think of anything. I don't think I'm good enough.
I would, if they say that to me, I say, I can help you, you know, but my advice basically is, you know, and I took this to heart, is write what you know.
Right.
Realizing that writing is a lonely, it's a labor intensive and time consuming endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of discipline. And also, before you start writing, share your story with somebody to get some feedback, and you know, they could, you know, offer some good advice for you. And that's what I did. You know, I had a narrative. In fact, I drafted up a prologue and then went to my three protagonists and said, "Hey, this is what I'm thinking." And they said, "Well, what about this, this, and that?" And so, okay, so you know, so I got that kind of feedback. But I think most of all is you got to have a really good editor or editors. You know, this last book, I had both you and Chris, and you guys just made my, you know, as my two editors, and you guys just made my narrative much stronger. And that I really appreciated. But I think it's important to have somebody that's going to give you some honest feedback. And an editor does not hesitate to do that.
Right.
And I think it's good. I mean, you know, there were changes that I made, adjustments that I made based on what you, Cersei, said and what Chris said. And, you know, I take it as your feedback is about making the story stronger. And that's how I took it, you know. And, you know, I don't have all the answers. I don't know all things. And I think that it's important. You know, I may not like it and it may hurt. You know, but I also know that you're not doing it out of malice or ill intent, or, you know, or just being plain mean, that it's about making the story better. And so, you know, that's how you got to look at it, too, is that, you know, yeah, it's going to be some harsh criticism, you know, but overall, it's about making the story better. And that's how I look at it.
Well, you know, and I think you're right, because I've had several people. I just interviewed Sarah Doran last week, and she wrote a children's book, and she ran the draft through her friends and her family, and they said, "Oh, it's really good." And then she thought, "Well, wait a minute. These are my friends and my family. I should write. I should run it through strangers or, you know, neutral people." And she got pretty much the same feedback. So she felt like she was on track. And I know another woman author did chapters of it for her book club. You know, her writers group, not book club, her writers group, and they gave her feedback, because it is. It can be. You know, it's better if you're going to be writing a book for people to read, you might want to get people's input into the book, right? So that they'll actually read it. Because it, you know, so I think it is lonely. I mean, you have to be disciplined. You're absolutely right. I'm getting up early to do writing and things for myself, because I can't do it during the day because I've got all the other stuff I have to do. And so, like, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm up doing some writing or, you know, and it is something that I would also encourage people, because to write, just because there's so much wonderful stuff or horrible stuff, or, you know, there's stuff inside you that should come out. It can help you understand and clarify. It can help heal. It can make you understand a situation, and it can just be fun.
I mean, I found it's not only a daunting task, but it's also introspective. And it's also sometimes therapeutic. I mean, for me, that's what it was. Mm-hmm. And it was fun recalling stuff. But I think that you got to be careful about who you give your book to ask them to read. But number one, you got to make sure they got the time.
Right.
Because it is timely. And you got to trust that they're just not going to go because they're your friend. Oh, Rick, this is really great. Yeah. You can't tell them. I mean, I know there must be something in there.
Right. And that's what Sarah said. You know, she ran it through her family first and her friends, and then she went on to bigger groups just to make sure she was on track.
You know, so, I asked Chris, and she's a friend, but boy, she was hard on me. You know, I'm questioning our relationship now.
Well, you know, there is a thick skin.
For what it was worth, you know, making the story stronger. That's why I looked at it.
Well, you know, some of the greatest sellers, the best writers, you know, have been rejected, you know, dozens of times. So, yeah. And it is subjective too, right? It's like some people will like your work. Some people won't. You know, some people love sci-fi. Some people hate it. So it is that.
Well, John Grisham tells a story that his first book, A Time to Kill, it took him 10 years before people even noticed his book.
Hmm.
And then they made it into a movie starring Matthew McConaughey and Sandra Bullock.
Hey, in the few minutes we have left, I have no idea how long we've been talking, but in the few minutes we've left, is there anything you wanted to say that I didn't ask you about?
The only thing I can think about is that I want to implore all brats to tell their story, whether it's in a book form or an article for an anthology or something like that. I mean, I've heard so many, as I mentioned to you already, so many inspiring stories, sad stories, happy stories. And I think for people to understand and not pigeonhole us or stereotype us is we have to tell our story so they see, like I see, the beauty and the diversity of military brats and families. You know, that there's just an incredible beauty in our story, and I think it just needs to be told. So I implore people to write, tell the story.
Okay, well, that's a good bit of advice to end on. This podcast certainly has meandered, but it couldn't have meandered with a more pleasant guest. I mean, you know, I wanted to thank you for coming on and hanging out. And I also wanted to thank our listeners for tuning in and to remind everyone that this podcast is brought to you by the Museum of the American Military Family and Learning Center in Tijeras, New Mexico. Stay tuned for the next location it's going to be coming from. And the museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and other organizations like Military Brat Seal and Military Brats Registry. Our guest today has been our brand new shiny board member, Rick Tavares, and he's the author of It Began in Japan and After Japan, The Pursuit. And we look forward to working with you on a lot of things in the near future. So thanks a lot, Rick.
No, thank you very much. It's a pleasure, and I appreciate it.
Well, it was fun.
Okay. Mahalo.
Mahalo.